nice of the NBA to return with such incredible games last night. Such thrilling, tight, invigorating contest. Leafs lay an absolute egg. Ooh, boy. It's forgivable. I talked about it on Leafs Talk last night. It's hard to get when they played as well as they did the night before against the Tampa Bay Lightning. It's especially difficult to get that mad when they were playing with a goaltender who I think has a lot of promise and people are high on, but he's new. He's young. He's, I think, 23 years old, not really supposed to be here, couldn't come up with a save early. And the Leafs end up dropping one. I don't want to say they quit on the game necessarily, because I thought that they did have some pushback in the second period. But yeah, I'm sure they checked out a little bit during the contest and thought, we've got games on Thursday and Saturday against tougher opponents. We've got a big game against St. Louis, which is a big game because of Craig Berube. And they've got the Boston Bruins on Saturday night. So thinking ahead of that one feels a little natural. Now, if those habits start to show up in other games, I think you're probably going to get a little bit more nervous quick. But it does show you how this fan base has always been impatient, right? I think that's pretty fair to say, Leafs fans. I think that you're very passionate. I think that you're a lot smarter than people give you credit for, that you know the game more than people give you credit for. But it's a thin membrane between happiness and complete and utter dissatisfaction with all of you, pretty much all of you. There is the positive brigade, but I actually think you're the most insufferable group of the bunch. Like, there's no one worse than the perpetually optimistic and happy sports fan who, during the lowest of lows, goes, "Come on, guys, that's great.
What if we had a good season? Together.
Matthews scored 69 goals. Don't you remember?" You go, "Yeah, okay. Now is not the time." I can still remember when the Leafs blew the lead to Boston, 2013, and my friends and I walked outside of the bar just distraught, just in complete disarray, head spinning, angry. Silence, right? Silence among us. And we just went outside. We're smoking a cigarette out there, and this dude comes up, and he's like clapping in front of everyone. He's not a Bruins fan. He's a Leaf fan, going, "Come on, guys. We got to rally," as though we're on the team. The game's not over yet, guys. Even though any human with, you know, a molecule in their brain, one little molecule of a brain, knew that that game was dead and over with. And I've never seen anybody take a beating in public like that. And I've seen people who've been jumped. taking an actual physical beatings. I would rather take one of those than the verbal assault that this guy got from a crowd of maybe 40, 50 Leaf fans.
Who thought the power of friendship was enough
Exactly. Or just the power of positivity and the idea that we were on the team. It's like when you go to the games and you're in the stands and there's somebody who's like, "Change!" Like coaching from the 300s. You turn around, you look, and you know what? Those guys always have a jersey it's like a custom jersey with their name on the back, and then a captaincy, like the C on the crest. Like, "I'm the captain of my house. I'm the guy." Anyways, the actual captain, my captain, Matt Sundin, is on the show today. I'm very excited to get to chat with him. I read his book yesterday. But before we do that, because he's calling in a couple minutes, and yeah, I got Versteeg later in the show, so we'll break down some of the other stuff with Leafs. Very Leafs heavy show today. But yeah, the NBA season started last night, and I'll be honest, because it was across from the Leafs game and that it was an immediate blowout, I didn't really see any of the Knicks. But yesterday I did my, "Hey, teams I'm excited for." And one was the Knicks and one was the Timberwolves, and they could not have looked worse. I was completely unaware of this Mikal Bridges jump shot thing.
Oh yeah. The changing his form. It looked, you know, rough early returns.
What do you mean changed his form?
Yeah.
That's a nightmare.
Oh yeah.
Like, that's not something you're fixing in season. Remember last year when people panicked about Grady Dick and you went, "Oh, his shooting mechanics are slightly different." But it took Sam Decker to be able to actually identify the tweaks and the changes they were making. Here's what I can promise you about Mikal Bridges' shot. Nobody went up to him and was like, "Hey, this is what I think you should do." Shoot it as though you've never played the sport before.
What if you added a really big hitch to the top of your jump shot?
Um, What if we played possum for the entire season and made everyone think you couldn't shoot, and then you showed up in the postseason and then you brought your jump shot back? Like, this is a guy who hit the big shot against Team Canada. I can never get this right. I will never. If I have an Achilles heel, it's knowing what is a world championship or a World Cup, unless it's soccer.
FIBA World Cup you're referring to.
Yeah. But I will. It doesn't matter how many times I've been told that. I watched all those games. Yeah. Everyone. I even was at a cottage weekend and hungover, woke up at 5 a.m. or whatever to watch that game on my phone in bed with headphones in, and then hated them for blowing that lead, going, oh my God, you made me wake up for this. This is dreadful. I could have slept through this. I could have. And then, of course, rewarded. But man, oh man, oh man. I'll never get that. I will never be able to tell you what is a world championship or a World Cup outside of soccer. I could be on a game show for $1 million. They could tell me that this is one of the prep questions. They could leak the question to me, and I think I would still have just the 50-50 shot of getting it right and go, World Cup? World Championship? It's just impossible. It's just impossible. But yeah, the Knicks were dreadful, and I didn't really see any of it, so I'm not going to really speak on it, but...
Yeah, the Celtics just couldn't miss. That was the biggest hit, a million threes.
That's good. Yeah. I felt like an idiot because I bet both wrong sides.
Ah, yes.
I took the points with the Knicks, but I just took the money line with the Timberwolves, and I went, trust me.
Starting off the NBA season hot.
Yeah, it reminded me that that's actually just blind betting, that was stupid. But I was really disappointed with how the Timberwolves looked. Like, it just, it's going to take a little while for that to coalesce. They're deep. They have a bunch of guys at each position. But yeah, that's just not... That is not a great-looking team to start. Didn't love the energy. But the Lakers came out, and it was their Super Bowl, right? Because it was a LeBron game. They went, oh, something for LeBron in this one. And Bronny comes out. He comes out in the second quarter. It's a very... I like how we all have to just say, oh, it's such a sweet story. It's an incredible story because fathers and sons. Like, yeah, okay. It's cool he has a son, and it's cool that he has a good relationship with his son, that he's had a career as demanding as LeBron's and seems to have a genuine connection with his kids, seems to have found time with his kids. And I know we see that through social media or whatever, but like, you can just see the way they interact with them. They clearly get along and they really look up to their dad. And he's seems to have found time to not just foster them as basketball players, but as young men, which is a cool and to me anyways, a bit of an inspiring story about LeBron. And one of the cool things about LeBron that we all do mention is that this is someone who had a tough upbringing and yet has always found a way to, be a really positive force in the NBA. Like, his biggest mistake off the court was the decision.
Yeah.
And I frankly blame far, 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 far more blame, put the blame on the people that were in his circle that thought that was a good idea. Like, that's clearly a thing where someone intervenes and goes, man, you're from Cleveland. This is really, like, you're from Akron, whatever. You're from Ohio. This isn't going to go very well. This is going to be pretty cringy. This probably won't age very well, even if the proceeds were going to charity for that event, which I don't think gets brought up enough. So I respect LeBron as a father, and I respect LeBron as a man, and I respect him as a player. But watching his son play in that game, like, Armin genuinely believed that he was going to come out there and play well. And I thought that was one of the worst looks ever. We all deal with some form of nepotism at different jobs or different parts of our lives. But what he looked 5'2" on the court.
Tiny.
He looked 5'2". And yeah, it's his first game, man. I'm not going to write off his entire career. Hope he has a shot at it. Like, I got nothing against Bronny. But that they put him out there and they let him run around for a few minutes. When I was a little kid, when I was a boy, when I was probably like 5 or 6, somewhere in that range, my dad coached a men's league team called the Porter Creek Tigers. My dad was a basketball coach. And I was a member of the team. I'm doing air quotes now. I was on the team. You know, I had a little fake, I had a t-shirt that was my jersey, and they custom made the t-shirt for me, right? Remember those goops that they used to put on shirts in the 90s, to make the custom shirts? Yeah, I had one of those for the Porter Creek Tigers. And when I was a little tiny kid, for one possession, they put me on and let me shoot free throws in this men's league game as a 5 or 6 years old. And I had, like, my friend, my best friend in the neighborhood at the game. And I remember looking at him, Jason, and going, I'm a star.
I've made it.
Yeah, like, I made it to the NBA. But I was 5 or 6, you know? So it's kind of excusable for me to be excited about that moment. I actually just felt bad for him watching it. Like, he was just so completely out of his depth. And I think the Lakers got caved in during that moment in the the basketball game.
Yeah, they did.
Where it's like all of a sudden the Timberwolves actually went on a run. And I went, boy, I don't know what the future of this holds, but that moment, sweet, very sweet moment, but ultimately something that didn't resemble really anything I had ever seen in sports before. So I guess that's something.
He had a wide open look for three.
Yeah, I missed it. Yeah, but that was, that was a weird one. Anyways, again, I mentioned it yesterday. I finally got my copy of Home and Away, Matt Sundin's new biography, the story of his career. I sat down, I read it all yesterday. I thought it was great. Matt Sundin joins me now, Home and Away, author of Home and Away, least all-time scorer, Hockey Hall of Fame, Olympic champion, Olympic gold medalist. What's up, Matt? How are we doing, man?
I'm very good. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing well. So what's more tiring, you know, playing back-to-back, you know, going on a long road trip, flying from Sweden after you win Olympic gold and having to play regular season games, or this media tour that you're on right now?
I'll say that flight back and having to play the same night in Toronto after about an hour and a half sleep. I think that was a little harder.
That was harder than the media tour, because I was like, you're doing so much stuff right now that I want to be like, I just feel like I should remind you. You know, you're rich, right? You don't have to do this. you probably pretty healthy bank account. I'm guessing this is a lot.
Right. It's great though, and we're out meeting, you know, Maple Leaf fans. Mm-hmm. New generations and the generations were around also when I played, so it's been great. We're around the GTA meeting fans and signing some books, so it's actually fun. And I don't get a chance to be in Toronto that often anymore, so I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah, I'm glad that you are. And, you know, I read the book yesterday, and I want to cover some ground from the book, but I'm always curious what inspires guys like you to actually put this down on paper, and then why the timing. And, you know, you mentioned the new generation of Leaf fans, and there's an anecdote in the book about, you know, the unfortunate thing about being an older father is that your kids didn't get to watch you play. And I'm curious how much of, like, the inspiration for you to write this book was to tell them your story, or to tell your story to the new generation of fans.
Yeah, well, I think there was a few reasons, obviously. One, I thought really last summer when we started the project, it was kind of, if I don't do it now, it's probably never going to get it done, right? I'm 53 years old. I still remember most of my childhood and playing in the National Hockey League. The most common question I get, even up until today, is, you know, how come you became a player in the National Hockey League, and what made you so good? So I hope the reader can get some of those those questions answered reading the book. I find, having kids myself, there's a lot of pressure early on when they're 8 and 9 years old about this vision of them going to the National Hockey League or making a living off of hockey. So that's one thing that I just like to write about. And I was very fortunate with my parents, you know, me and my brothers growing up, it was all about the passion for the game. So, and then the other thing, I think you're on a little bit, you know, my kids, they're 12, 10, 7 right now. They're playing basketball. Middle guy plays hockey, and I'm driving them all around the city, but they just give me no respect for my hockey career.
So that's why you put the stats at the back page. You're like, look at this. You have to
watch
see.
I'm asking them, you guys want to watch a YouTube clip when I scored a big goal? They're like, no. I can't even see it's you. It's such a
that's harsh. The video quality to them is just night and day.
So, you know, I hope they can pick it up in 3 and 5 years or maybe later and say, hey, our dad, he was a pretty good hockey player. So anyway, there was a few different reasons, and we got it done. And you know what? It was actually a fun process. Amy Stewart, my co-writer, she coaches hockey herself. She has three sons, and it was really fun working with her.
Yeah. So, again, one of the big takeaways I had from the book, when you're talking about why did I become a hockey player, how did I become a hockey player, is how improbable your journey actually was. Because, I watched you as a fan, and you know, you look at you in your career, it's like, yeah, he's the first overall pick. You know, you're tall, you're big, you're talented. Seems kind of obvious, right? You look like the personification of a hockey player. But then reading about your upbringing in like relative isolation in remote Sweden, and being one of, you know, the, you know, 15 years old, you're one of the best players in the entire country, and somebody asks you if you're going to keep playing hockey, like, that's not a very Canadian thing, you know? If you're 15 years old in Canada, and you're winning major tournaments and you're leading the thing in scoring, if someone asked you, are you still going to play hockey, it would probably be the weirdest question that any kid was ever asked. And, it's just, it's wild to think about how you got here. And I am curious, when you were reflecting on it and you were putting this all down, how much it did dawn on you that this could have just not happened so very easily.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because Amy Stewart, after a couple of weeks we're working, she's like, are you serious about this right here? This is really, she was laughing about, just like you're reflecting on it right now. But don't forget either, you know, 1986, 87, 88, it was a different world out there. Mm-hmm. And Europe and the rest of the world, North, we were all kind of isolated. So growing up in Sweden, for me, it was, you know, dreaming about playing for the national team and beating, at the time, Soviet Union. It was just hammering Sweden. Every tournament, they were beating them 8-1 and 6 for like a decade. And, you know, in Sweden, we got news about the National Hockey League. Like 3 days after the actual game, there was this little note in the paper that the Rangers beat Toronto, whatever, 3-2. And we were not connected the way we are today. So, and it's kind of cool to reflect on that in the book as well. But in terms of when I look back and not being pressured or thinking that I was going to, you know, go to the National Hockey League early, it really helped me, I think, manage the you know, being the captain for the Toronto Maple Leafs and play 13 years. And it made me, you know, it gave me a very safe, and I felt very grounded once I started my NHL career and kind of knew where I was coming from, and really, it made it easier for me to play the, you know, the 18 years I did in the National Hockey League.
Yeah. You know, this is actually a theme that I want to talk to you about from the book too, which is, yeah, like, you didn't have that hype. You didn't have those NHL dreams. Like, you're mentioning that it was days before you even got the news. You know, reading it, it also dawned on me that, you know, Boreas Salming to you as a kid would have been like, it's like a myth. It's a legend. It's the same thing as me hearing a story about, you know, someone who's a dragon slayer. You're like, oh, okay, sure. Yeah. it's not something tactile. It's not even like really real to you. It's just, it's more of an idea than it is something that is a reality. And here you are again with very little hype, with very little belief or I think any kind of goal of making the NHL. And, you know, throughout the book, it's like, you're just a hockey player. You have a real passion for it, you know, whether it's trying to play with your brother, whether it's, you know, you starting your own ball hockey league, all of these different things, not feeling that pressure. Yeah. It made me really think about where hockey is today. So much of it is professionalized, right? You look at kids, like, I have friends who have kids who are 7 years old, and you look at their stalls and it's like your stall with the Maple Leafs, right? Like, they have everything at their disposal. There's a ton of pressure from parents. It's extremely expensive. Yep. And so parents feel the pressure to try to get the most out of the league and to get more ice time for the kids. The thought of the NHL is something, especially here, I'm not sure how much this is like that in Sweden, but it's
same.
Yeah. Okay.
Same
so now. It's just very intense. And I find, and I'm not trying to be like old man yelling at the clouds, but I worry at times about us losing passion for the game, like players who have just real passion rather than it being homework, right? Like, when you were a kid, hockey was your escape. And I wonder for a lot of kids now if it feels like their first job rather than something that they have a passion for. And so when writing this stuff, did you feel that? Like, did you reflect on, you know, what your own kids are going to kind of go through and how different the hockey world now is for youth?
Yeah, and you know what? I'm really glad you brought it up. I think it's one of the most important messages when we try to write this book, me and Amy, is if you look at the Connor McDavid's, Austin Matthews today, the best players in the world today, or you look back to the Gretzky's, Lemieux's, whoever they are, Joe Sakic, I play with, Nicholas Lidstrom, Peter Forsberg. You look at all the great players of all time, and I think that's no different today. The guys are playing today in other generations. The passion that is within that kid or the guy who's dominating in the National Hockey League is the same, right? It drives all the best players and it gets them through their teens, try to make it into the National Hockey League and beyond. They want to improve. They want to get better. But, you know, that the fire burning inside, and I agree with you, when you, you know, try to make the 8 or 9 or 10-year-old feel like he's surrounded and supported like he's already in the National Hockey League, it's not going to help him get through, right? I agree with education is important in terms of skating and stick handling and all that, and you have to learn how to compete and you have to learn different things as you get older, but you don't, and our message is really, you like, don't get serious too early because there's a big chance you'll kill that passion of, that all these kids have inside. You know, it's going to get serious soon enough. By the time they're early teens and into their teens, it should get more serious. You know, you have to do more workouts and you have to work off ice and you know, the fitness and all the things that comes with that. So I'm glad you brought it up. And I think that hasn't changed today. And I think a lot of great talent might disappear in their teens because they're going to be sick of hockey already if you get serious too early.
Yeah, that's I think that's really well said, and especially from someone who, yeah, carries the weight that you do in terms of hockey in this city and in your country. It's true. Like, it's just I see a lot of it, and I don't have kids. And so, you know, it's not something that I'll usually speak on going like, oh, this is my direct experience. But like, as an outsider, when I do look at it, I'm like, that just doesn't seem fun. It doesn't seem like an escape. This seems like a part-time job to me. That feels like when I first had to, you know, deliver a newspaper more than it does when I was just like going and getting together with my friends and being like, hey, we're just going to go play ball hockey and have some fun together.
Yeah, and you know what? The combination, and there's studies on this too. Like, we know it's true. So if you specialize too early and you're starting to over putting in the hours when you're at age 7 or 8 or even earlier, some people, you know, it's going to affect you both physically, because when you're a kid, you need to be moving and jumping and doing all different activities to be healthy going into your as you grow, but also maybe even more mentally, like we talked about, like that passion. If you're a parent and your kid really just want to play hockey every day, 4 or 5 hours a day, I think the best thing a parent can do when they're 7, 8 years old, you know what? Now it's summertime. Let's play baseball or do something else for a couple months. Hockey's still going to be there once fall comes around. So it's you know, the longer the we can keep the play and play around the game, the better and the bigger chance the kids are going to enjoy hockey for a longer period of time.
You know, it's incredible that you say that, because it's something that has been reiterated from every single great player that I've ever spoken to, from like Bobby Orr.
There you go.
It's the same message from everyone. Like, hey, play other sports, play other sports. Exactly. And then you meet the hardcore hockey parents. It's like, does your kid play any other sports? They're like, goodness, no, we've got to travel. We got summer league. We got this, we got that. It's like, we got dry land. You go, okay. All right. I feel like you should probably like listen to Matt Sundin over, you know, you, but sure. Sure. I guess, yeah. You played the GTHL.
Pick up the book and read it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah,
but I'm glad, because you kind of see the underlying message, and I hope the readers will enjoy that part as well.
You know what, though? One of the things, too, though, from that is it's very clear how good your parents were. Like, just from your lifelong relationship with them. Listen, I could never stay with my family in tight quarters for long times. Like, you being in an apartment and all sleeping together, like, I just traveled with my family to Europe this summer, and we stayed in separate rooms, and I was with them for 3 weeks in a row, and by the end of it, I was like, I love you so much, but it's over. The only part I related to you with your family was when your grandfather comes and stays with you, and you're like, yeah. By the time it was over, goodbye. I got a good laugh out of that.
Yeah. Well, don't forget, right? I was 19 at the beginning when they came over. And then they came for, you know, 3 days of Christmas when I got older.
Yeah.
But in terms of helping me out, I mean, I have two brothers. We were into all kinds of sports growing up. And if I can do with my kids now, like I'm at that point myself, I have a 12-year-old, 10-year-old, and a 7-year-old that I'm driving on this basketball and this piano lesson, there's hockey practice, there's tennis and dance and whatever else. And if I can do half of the job my parents did, like, you know, the 7 a.m. practice on Sundays or Saturdays, I'm going to do a good job. So we were lucky. I think you realize when I look back at my my childhood and my career, you know, I was fortunate to have my parents just were there for the support. Like, mm-hmm. there was no pushing, there was no pressure. Like, my dad, they saw early that I had a different talent than my other two brothers. But not until, you know, I was 16 or 17, there was agents coming to my house. One of the agents, I remember, and I think we have it in the book, you know, one of the agents said, you know, Matt's going to have a long, great career in the National Hockey League. And my dad goes, we're not sure about that.
Yeah.
But, yeah. But, you know, so it was kind of a naive thing, but it really helped me, you know, progress. And so I was fortunate to have him around when I was young.
Yeah. So that's one of the other things, though, that it's hard not to take away, which is you have this passion from being a kid, right? You've got the younger brother complex, yeah. where it's like you're chasing around your brother and you're just always wanting to be involved in sports. You basically have yeah. one blip in your childhood when you're a teenager and you're starting to have success where, you know, yeah. you don't let hockey become your maybe primary focus. But throughout your life, throughout your career, yeah. like it's just extremely clear where your priorities laid, whether it was, you know, your yeah. routine as a player, the dedication you put in during the off season, your desire to win, like all of these things, right? But yeah. that makes me feel like it had to be really hard to step away. And that's why I was surprised that, you know, at the end of the book, when you're talking about your time in Vancouver, that you felt it was yeah. over and that you did feel some closure. And I am curious, like when you yeah. have that level of passion, how difficult yeah. is it to put it into other things? How hard is it when you're writing this book to go down those memories yeah. and to feel that stuff and just really yeah. feel like it's closed?
You know what? I still love the game, though.
Yeah.
Right? And I started playing a couple years ago. I play once a week on Fridays for an hour. There's some former NHLers over in Sweden and some other guys that play in the Swedish league. We play pickup, first to three goals, start a new game. You know, no slap shots, no hitting, obviously. Yeah. Still enjoy it as much. But, you know, professional sports, whether it's women's or men's, and it's for young people, right? So at 38, you know, when you get on the road or you're flying out of to get on the road and you get to a new city, you're preparing for a game the next day. All the other guys in the team are between 20 and 25. They're playing video games on the plane and you're kind of, you know, reading a book or something. You get phased out. So, and at the same time, I was doing it for so long. Mm. And when I look back now and I see the teams play, you know, they're playing every other night. I know what they're doing. They're playing games. They're practicing. They sleep, eat, travel, play again, do it all over again. Mm-hmm. So saying that, you know, and the only thing I really miss, because I was always also enjoying being part of the team. I think that's why I enjoy being the captain. But so, you know, the thing of being part of a group, trying to achieve a goal and win this week or this game or try to win a championship, that's something I miss. I also miss when you step on the ice in hockey or I think in probably any professional sports, you only live in the moment, right? Mm. So there's no thinking about the future. There's no thinking about yesterday. And that's tough to find those moments now when you have kids and you got to plan the week or pick someone up at a time, where you just live in the moment for that hockey game and you enjoy it. And those were special things that it's tough to recreate later in life.
So you never thought about coming back after you retired?
No, you know what? I was going to, you know, that last year with Toronto, mm-hmm. I played out the season. I didn't weigh my no trade and I finished the year. I told my agent, JP Bear, you know what? I'm done. I'm not going to play any more hockey. JP calls me 1st of July. He says, and I was unrestricted free agent. And I had a really strong season that year with the Leafs, my last year. I had over 30 goals, and I had almost, I think, a point a game,
yep.
or maybe even more. And JP goes, Matt, you know, we have a great offer from Vancouver. And I said, you know what, JP, I think I'm done. And then I was going to say something more, and all I heard was he hung up the phone.
Yeah.
Like, he was gone. He was so upset with me. And then we talked a couple of days later. So I didn't really, until September, when my whole body and brain said, it's time to play hockey again. Mm-hmm. Then I was like, well, maybe I should try just to play a little more. And then I couldn't start until obviously halfway through the season because I didn't work out the whole summer. You know, that's the way the last year's day went down.
Yeah, but it, like after the final year in Vancouver, like after that final playoff yeah. exit, you never had even a moment where you're yeah. like, maybe I'll just get on the ice. Like you get no. back with Leif, you just try one more time.
No. And I was old, right? You're 38. So it takes, if you look at the guys, they're 20, 25. They have a short warm-up. They go out and practice at the highest level, play games. When you're 38, you got to warm up for a good 45 minutes. Once the game is over or practice, you got to get back in the gym and just cool down. It's just your body is not where it is when you're 25.
Yeah, why do you think Guy Lafleur was there an hour before you?
Exactly. So that was me in Vancouver. I was Guy Lafleur, same age.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, so I want to get into your journey here because, again, it is remarkable how unlikely that it actually seemed. And, yeah, if you want to talk about what the biggest difference is in terms of the sign of the times, it's that a first overall pick didn't just go back to his home country but worked part-time driving around his country selling hardware as he is the first round overall pick. Again, something that I don't think will ever happen again. But you have this tumultuous exit, right, from your team in Sweden. You're the first European that goes first overall, which is like a very well-documented thing. But yeah, coming over here and learning the language and then even having to like take French lessons and just a lot of the isolation and the things that you went through. We obviously recently have really reflected on Boreas Alming's career, right? And thought about what a trailblazer he was. And in your book, you know, you mentioned McGillney gets and Bure, those two guys get spoken of often. Like when you mention their names, it's always brought up how they are trailblazers, right? It's synonymous with who they are. Yeah. And I'm curious if... Yeah. Like, I don't like using the word credit because that makes it seem like an ego thing, but do you think that that is affiliated with you enough, that that's something that's mentioned with your career enough? Just given, again, like truly what a trailblazer you were in the sport.
Well, I don't know about that, you know, because you're right. At the time when I came over to the National Hockey League, I think there was like 17 Swedish players that were playing in the league or up and down in the AHL, and right now there's over 100. I think it's maybe 117. So, but I think, you know, every generation is can influence the next one, right? So Bore paved the way for us. I think he opened the eyes for general managers and not only in Toronto but in the league, where they question, you know, Swedish players and European players, can they really handle the tougher game, the more intense game that we play in North America. And Bore really showed that works. So he helped our generation. And then, you know, later we came in and played. And you look at the league today. So I think we've had, you know, the Swedish hockey program has been really good, you know, for a quite amount of time now. Even though, you know, Sweden is a small country. It's 11 million people. And there's only, I think, 80,000 registered hockey players total. So we've been producing a lot of good players for a long period of time, but it's so important. I agree with you that you get the Boris Salmings and the Lidstrom, Forsberg, Sundins. Mm-hmm. It makes the kids start to play hockey, and now you got the Nylander and the Elias Pettersson and the Victor Hedman and Eric Karlsson. So, but it has to continue. You know, it's not an automatic, and Swedish hockey have to keep working on that to make sure that we can keep getting players to play at the highest level.
So, and again, like in comparing you to Boreas Salming, one of the things that is well documented was the cruelty that he had to endure as, you know, the first Swedish player here. That, you know, guys really took runs at him, really were incredibly, incredibly over the top physical, like assaulted the guy. One of the things I was really surprised by in the book is that you're the first overall pick, you come over here. You know, there is, as you mentioned throughout the novel or the book, about how there's so many times where you had to fight against, or that there was being really pushed the idea of like the chicken Swede or the soft European player. And so you would think, like, with this attention on you and playing in that market, and then also your size, that it's like you're a big guy who's, you know, what, 6'4", and, you know, you stand out quite a bit, that guys would take runs at you, and then you're there, like, it's very little in the book. You're like, yeah, I liked the physical play. And I'm curious what the physicality was like for you, if you felt like guys were really taking shots at you, if it was rougher than you let on in the book.
No, yeah, they do. But you know what? They do on everyone that comes into the league. I think it doesn't matter if you're from Sweden or whatever. If you're a high pick, you know, you are going to get tested, right? Whether it's being hit or there's a fight. And I never mind that part of the game. I didn't have a problem with it, you know. But it was a shock coming to – and I remember one of my first exhibition games in – with Quebec, you know, I think we played Buffalo or something. There's a bench clearing brawl, and I'm sitting on the bench. I'm looking, where are all these guys going? And I get on the ice, and I'm trying to find the smallest guy on the Sabres. I think I had my first fight the first year at the end of the year, one of the last games. It was against Buffalo, I think, on the road. And I think it was Dave Hahn at the time. He just speed bagged me. But I didn't get cut or anything, and I got to the penalty box, and Tony Twist, our tough guy that was on a team, comes up to me and he goes, "Mats, you know what, keep your gloves on. That didn't look good." All right. So yeah. At the same time, I knew my job. But, you know, I can count my fights over my long career on one hand. I think my to become after Gary Roberts was one guy that I fought, Dave Hanna and Ray Bourque. And I say Ray Bourque and Gary Roberts I actually beat up. I keep telling Rob. So I was 2-1 in my three fights over 18 years.
That's pretty good. That's a lot better than a lot of other guys have done. So I wasn't really prepared for the book to start with your return wearing the Vancouver sweater. And it was fairly emotional because I think a lot of Leaf fans were very much like you that evening, where it was very emotional. It's genuinely one of the most memorable sporting experiences for me personally. Like, it was a massive, massive, massive deal. But again, the thing that I found most interesting from it was not your recollection, that where it's just like, man, you start the book, you open it up, and you have to dive right into all those feelings you had. But it was that you weren't sure people loved you here.
It was, but you know what? It was just the way it ended, I think, my last year with the Leafs. Mm-hmm. And I understand, you know, the National Hockey League, it's a business. And Toronto Maple Leafs, at the end of my last season with Toronto, try to do what's best for the organization in the long run. And I felt that, you know, we're only, you know, whatever it was, 3 or 4 points out of the playoffs when I got asked to waive my no trade. And I said, listen, we have a chance to make it in, and I want to stay here and finish the season. So, but saying that though, it was such a media circus for that the last 3 months, it's impossible. If you've been in a team for 13 years, you're the captain for 11 years, it gets personal, right? So there was a lot of nerves leading up to that game with the Canucks come back to Toronto, and for me. You know, Toronto is the hockey capital of the world. They have the best hockey fans in the world. So it was very emotional for me as well.
Yeah. Speaking of the trade request stuff, you know, it's at the end of the book. It's small, but you can tell how much it hurt you, right? Like the request itself, the narrative that built, and the frustrations that you dealt with as the captain of this team who took a lot of pride in that and still trying to make the playoffs with the Leafs. And I am curious... how much did that shape your relationship with the team, and how long did that take to heal?
Yeah. Well, you know what? I was fine with it. I think I never saw it as a real problem. I really, even when I got asked the question, understood the, you know, that Toronto Maple Leafs didn't do anything wrong. They tried to make what they felt was best for the organization and starting a rebuild and get some players for me. So I am, there's no regrets there. But saying that, though, it's still, you know, it's when you have invested so much time and energy into the team and into your play here, it's everybody, I think all players, of course you take it personal when things like that happen. But saying that, it's part of the game. That's what you sign up for.
You're a better guy than me because, I thought about how, you know, reading it from your perspective, you're putting yourself, or like myself, in your shoes. And I'm thinking, like, right after your retirement, right, and the Leafs are honoring you and you're out there with a lot of these same people, like, you know what is a little different is, and what I would take a little personally is someone of your stature, when it's done in private, like asking you to waive that no trade and then for it to be leaked immediately and have it be done with that way. That's not something that is usually done. Maybe now, because the pressures of social media, it's done differently because teams know what it's going to be like. But for you to stand there with all those people and be like, "Hey, good to see you again." Management that leaked this, obviously. Yeah, you're just a bit. I would have held that grudge forever, and I would have put the screws to the team for it in the aftermath when they were trying to like capitalize on the emotions of your career. Definitely.
Yeah. Well. Yeah,
that's me. Exactly. Yeah, now you know. Hey, I read your whole book. Now you know a little bit about me. It's like, don't cross
that's
me. Because I'll never forget it. I will never, ever forget it.
Yeah.
Okay, so I got a couple more things. And I'll let you go. You've been super generous with the time. Yeah. So 96, you start to get really serious about your body and, you know, your off-season conditioning and, you know, your career is starting to become, you're a little bit deeper into it. And I'm curious when you're watching the Leafs stars right now, the guys that are in their prime, if that's what you're starting to see, is a collection of players that are starting to take the off-ice, the off-season, and the time that they have left with the game a little bit more seriously.
Well, I think, you know, you grow, right? And for me personally, you know, the older you get, if you get into and you play a few seasons and you realize how hard it is to you know, go have a long run in the playoffs, you are, you want to turn every stone to make sure you're doing everything is possible to be as good as you can be. So as I got older, I realized too, and it's a you know, when you're 20, 25, but you have to keep improving because there's always new kids coming into the league and want to push you out of a job, really. It's so competitive, and it was the same when I played and maybe even more so today. So fitness part of it, definitely I got better and better at as my career went on. And after 30, I realized, if I want to continue playing the game, I have to really make sure that I can compete with the young guys coming in. And if you look at the, you know, I was fortunate this training camp, I was invited by Brad Treliving to spend a few days with the team. And if you look at the Toronto Maple Leafs today, you know, it's on the ice, I think it's a fantastic group. I think management did a great job with the additions they made. But also in the dressing room, you know, this is a serious group. They do everything right. And, you know, I think Leaf fans gonna enjoy this season. And it's going to be interesting to watch them all year.
So this season we also get the return of best-on-best hockey with the Four Nations. And, yeah, the Olympics going to return in 2026. And, you know, your game-winning goal in the World Championships and the Olympics. And it's well-documented throughout the book what international play meant to you. And especially from, again, as you mentioned, your era where the NHL was nothing for a long period of your life or a long period of your childhood. But, yeah, what do you think this is going to mean now that we've had such a long layoff from this? Is it going to be embraced the same way, do you think? Is it going to feel as important, do you think? Like, you can speak about this from a Swedish perspective and a Canadian perspective because, you know, you've spent a lot of time in both countries. I am kind of curious to see how long it ramps up to feeling like, here's what it won't feel like. It's not going to feel like the ethnic tensions of you and the Soviets, you know, growing. It's not going to have that level of import, I think. But, yeah, it does. Yeah. Like, for me, I'm very excited, but I am kind of curious what becomes of it.
Yeah. But one thing is clear. I think hockey needs best-on-best tournaments, just like all other sports, right? Mm-hmm. So the hockey now finally is going to be back in the Olympics in 26, I think, which is it's going to be very important. So the best-on-best tournament, Four Nations, I think is a great start. I think Team Canada, the Team U.S., and it's Finland and Sweden, obviously, you would like to have a few more countries involved, but to showcase the world's best players. So the next one is the big, I think, obviously, is the Olympics.
In 2026.
Where the best players can compete for Olympic gold. And hockey, just like any other sport, needs to keep growing. So we're not only U.S. and Canada and some countries in Europe. We need to have the rest of the world actually get to watch this great game that we have. So I think it's very important to get a consistency of these. Doesn't have to be every year, but, you know, within near futures, have the best on best tournaments, because I think that will draw a lot of attention around the world, maybe even in countries where hockey is not so big.
Yeah, I think that's important. But and I think this is right, but here in Canada, obviously, like, hockey has been so integral to national identity, and not having best on best, I think, has actually been difficult. And I would imagine that it's the same for Swedes, where, it's a huge part of the social fabric, the cultural fabric, and to have it not happen this long, it does feel like there's something missing. And so
I agree.
I hope that hole or that void is filled. I'll leave you with this, because you've been super generous with the time, and God, I don't know how many of these you still have to do. You mentioned that you feel more Canadian at times than Swedish, and I'm curious if there's something, a habit, a saying, anything, a dietary thing, whatever it is, that people back home tease you about as, you know, you being Canadian, something that you've really kept from this country that you're sort of religious about back home?
Yeah. I'll give you two things.
Yeah.
So I'm back home. I do feel like when I land in Toronto, where I come from, and this summer we had the whole family. We visited some friends in Toronto and Muskoka. We're out in Nova Scotia with the kids because I really feel it's important for my kids to see how, what Canada meant to me, being in Toronto meant to me. So that's very important for me. Mm-hmm. Peanut butter and jam. Mm-hmm. I eat that at home.
All
right. My wife's like, why are you buying peanut butter?
Is it easy to get?
It's not common. You can get it, but yeah, it's not common for Swedes to eat that. Okay. But that's something I have, toast and all that, once in a while. And my wife looks at me like, you're not a kid anymore. Like, yeah, why are you eating that? It just makes me feel good. I said, and also on weekends in Sweden where we live, you know, people kind of, it's very different from living in Canada when I did anyway, you know, weekends. I always, you know, you wear a t-shirt, track pants, you're just going to hang around the house. I'll take the kids some places, you know, we relax. And in Sweden, you know, we would have the neighbor over once and they're all dressed up, you know, they got their jackets on and so forth. So, and they looked at me like, oh, yeah, is it, when they come in our house, is this something, you have, is something from North America or Canada? Yeah. I said, you know what? It's weekend. We like to relax.
I was going
to
say, that sounds exhausting. I'll never retire in Sweden, that's for sure. Like, I would never be able to do that. That's way too much for me. Again,
we don't care, though. They can come as dressed up as they want. We still wear
just lounging around. The book is called Home and Away by Matt Sundin. It's informative. It's emotional. It was really funny. I laughed more than a few times. It's, again, shockingly relatable for anyone who's had to break out and make it on their own away from home. Aspiring, forthcoming, covers your lengthy tenure as a Toronto Maple Leaf, full of anecdotes. I think a must read for Leaf fans of all ages. Matt Sundin, thanks so much for making time today, man. Good luck with the rest of the book.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, take care, man. Matt Sundin, one of the greatest Leafs of all time. Let's take a quick break. It's really cool how much of a connection he feels to the city, by the way. Like, that was the part when you're reading about the no trade clause and looking back on it for the way this whole city was. You're like, ooh, that's tough. Good thing he's a good guy. You know, good thing he's a forgiving person, because that would be a real stain if that would have ended up going the way that it easily could have with other people. You know, Armin and I have been joking about, who said it? Stephon Diggs? What was the quote? I'll never be the bigger person. I'll never be? Yeah, that's me. Like, I read that quote and I went, totally agree.
Don't good be the, points.
Good point. Like, ideally, but the thing is that you don't get to be Stephon Diggs, so you don't get to, like, you have to live in the real world. So
that's the ultimate Trump card.
Yeah, it's, you're not even really being the bigger person. You're more just, like, capitulating to the situation. You're actually the smaller person. That's why you have to be the bigger person, you know? Like, if that makes sense. If that makes sense. You got to be small to be big. You got to be small in order to have to be big. Whatever. Something along those lines. But yeah, like, for him to be just like, yeah, I got over it. It's like, okay, that's nice. That's good. Because, I don't think a lot of people would have. Anyways, let's take a quick break, and then I got some closing thoughts before we get to Christopher Stieg on some of the Bronny stuff.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
So I just have a closing thought on the LeBron thing from last night. Him and Bronny, they step out on the floor together and whatever. However you interpreted it, fine. Like, if you viewed it as like a cool father and son moment, great. Here's what drove me absolutely insane, though, that I could barely handle it when it was going on the broadcast, was this comparison to the Griffies. Like, really?
Yeah, they were there and there was lots of pictures beforehand and stuff.
Ken Griffey Jr. was the biggest prospect in the sport and came in, and I actually had this conversation with Ennis the other day just in private, because I sent him an old Griffey clip from some documentary that was there, and I said, how many people have done more in terms of popularized baseball than Ken Griffey Jr., right? And his dad was an incredible player in his own right. The idea that those guys are in any way comparable, or that it's like bring in the Griffies, that this is the modern day Griffies, is like the most insane part of this entire story. Like, Bronny is not in the NBA if not for his name. Ken Griffey Jr. was going to be in Major League Baseball if his name was Joe Smith. It did not matter. He was going to be there. And this just LeBron, like, Mike is chirping me at the beginning of the show. He's like, you're a LeBron hater. You're a LeBron hater. He's just annoying me right away. Like as soon as the day starts, like he's just not contributing anything other than annoying me. And I'm like, no, I don't hate LeBron. I've actually been a huge fan of LeBron's like entire career. There's so much to LeBron that I really like, but this is the part that I can't separate from the Bronny story is that it's just like, this was just for you. This wasn't even really about Bronny to me. Like Bronny doesn't belong here. And the fact that you're doing like, we're like the Griffies. It's like, dude, you can't have everything. You're not everything to everyone. It's just, it's too much, man. It's just too much. The Griffey thing. I just sat there and I honestly want to turn the TV off. I was like, this is just absurd that people are going along with this. Like the broadcast, like the Griffies, they're just like the Griffies. It's like, okay. All right. Ken Griffey Jr. Actually, I don't think he went in unanimous. I think one guy was like, no. Yeah, right?
I mean, he's not ready for
the Hall of Fame.
Wasn't that during the era of like, well, if Babe Ruth wasn't unanimous,
shut up. Yeah, that was so stupid. Because I think Mariano Rivera was the first guy that went in that was unanimous. Anyway, either way, just enough. I'm just glad, based on the way he played and how he looked and all of that, and I think it's done now. I think we can put this to bed, and then it's like, oh, yeah, if he never plays again, guess who it was all about? LeBron, not Bronny. Anyway.
Griffey was on 437 of 440 votes.
Yeah, like... someday, surely Bronny. Anyways, let's take a quick break, come back, and let's talk to Christopher Stieg. So, yeah, it's a flush it game. Goodbye. It's not fun that the getting blown out by Columbus, they got to bring up the comeback against Columbus, the 5-game non-playoff series that the Leafs still get credit for. As a playoff series somehow, even though it wasn't. Oh, they lose in the first round. Like, that wasn't even the first round. That year, they would have killed for the first round. But I actually did think there was going to be a moment. But then, yeah, you reminded... The difference was with thinking the Leafs were going to come back in that one versus what happened for them in the postseason in 2021. Not only did I think that they weren't going to control the play the way they did, but also I just didn't think that they were going to be able to get a stop, period. Like, I didn't think Hildeby was going to give him a chance in net, that he was going to make zero saves. It was never going to happen for them that, even though it was a 5-1 game or at one point when they were pushing, I thought, like, okay, maybe if they make it, you know, 4-1, they could get back in this game. But they just didn't have a goalie in net who could make the saves. And again, he's not supposed to be here. He's a kid. He's 23. He's a prospect. He was called up because of an injury, and I'm sure some type of a waiver issue with Matt Murray. But that is one thing that I do have as like a take from the goaltending thing is you got to let that kid develop in the AHL and let him continue to develop. But also, yeah, if you need a goalie in a pinch, get Matt Murray up here next time. It should be Matt Murray, not Dennis Hildeby. And that seems harsh off one game where like, oh, give him a chance. Like, yeah, I don't know. I don't want to hurt the... I think the confidence thing usually gets overplayed in sports. Like, I think you either have it or you don't. You have the self-belief to try to find something internal to say, I'm going to prove doubters wrong. Like, whenever they bring it up with quarterbacks, they're like, oh, what is confidence? It's confidence. I worry more about the habits you form, right? Like, the lowering of the eye level. But with the young goaltender like that, where you had an awesome first start, and then you have one like that, where it's just, woof. You look like, yeah, it's the... Like, that's what David Ayers looked like. It's just a guy who couldn't track the puck and didn't see it. And the saves he made were the pucks that hit him, not the ones that he actually stopped. But, yeah, hopefully he gets a little bit of run in the AHL because, yeah, I certainly don't blame him for that. Anyways, Christopher Stieg created the Clever app, partnered with Quench Hydration, 2-time Stanley Cup champion. What's up, buddy? How we doing?
You're blaming Hildeby.
I'm not blaming him. That wasn't blame. I
hopped on late.
I was just saying that one of the takes I have is that he should probably have more seasoning in the minors, and that I don't want him being in there for back-to-backs, right, behind a goaltender. Yeah. They played this incredible game in Tampa Bay. They pushed really hard. They clearly didn't have their legs, and they didn't play very well. I think Matthews called the neutral zone the Autobahn because, yeah, Columbus was just off the rush, off the rush, off the rush. It was a tough, tough, tough game to put him in there for.
You could have put Marty Brodeur in his prime, and that's a 6-1 game still.
You think so?
It does, yes.
The second goal.
I mean, how many odd man rushes and lack of details, floating around in the ozone, not hunting back? I mean, you can only give up so many odd man rushes and clean looks. Doesn't matter who's in net. That's how if I was looking at it as Craig Ruby today, Hildeby was the least of my worries from that game. It is a back-to-back, and you're going to have that. And those days happen. It's nothing to panic about. But as me looking, you know, I mean, I pretty much turned it off at, I think it was 4 or 5-1.
Oh, good went for back you. I had to watch the whole game. That's when it feels like a job where you're just like, oh, yeah, do a show right after.
But it looked like they were just playing straight up last year pond hockey.
Yeah.
And, I mean, to me, Ildeby would have been the last of my worries.
Yeah. I don't think it's more like I'm blaming him for the loss. I'm more, hey, I think he needs to play games. Like,
yeah,
you got to put
start him on the first game, right, if you want to get Stolarz on the second.
Or just, no, I just mean, like, in the AHL, he's got runway to actually start and play and see pucks and be on the ice. And that's just what he needs as a 23-year-old right now. Like, what he doesn't need is to be riding the bench and playing once every 2 weeks. And then when he does get those experiences, it's a game like that one where he gets absolutely shell-shocked, right? Like, that's just it for me. Is I'd rather have Matt Murray in that role if he has to be.
The Devils, right?
Yeah, the last one was the Devils game.
On the back-to-back.
Yeah, and he played well. But the Leafs were also super up for that game because they understood the stakes of it, right? This was more of your classic trap game where you played extremely hard the night before against a big opponent. And then, yeah, you took Columbus for granted and they didn't have their legs. They didn't skate and they didn't back-check. There was, like you mentioned, no attention to detail. They were sloppy. They were disconnected. Like, whatever negative adjective you want to use about the Leafs last night, like, you can fire away because that's who they were. But the question I have for you is about the Berube handling. You know, he didn't seem overly upset about it, which I thought personally was kind of the smart way to handle it, especially given he's got this game against St. Louis coming up once all the guys kind of focused on that. But yeah, what was the most difficult thing from a coach for you? Like, did you hate it more when a guy tore your head off? Did you hate it more when a coach was silent and kind of left the room just to be like, sit in it? Like, what do you have memories of just what the most painful way for a coach to approach you? What resonated most with you as a player when it came to accountability?
Yeah, I've played for the best coaches. I've played for the hardest coaches. If you get the Sutter brothers, both Sutter brothers, Wenzel, Peter Laviolette, every coach has a different way to go after a win or a loss. Quenzel comes in after a win, gives a quick pump, leaves. He'll never come in after a loss. Sutter, different. He comes in after a win and a loss.
Yeah.
And after wins, you think you've lost.
Yeah.
And after losses, sometimes you've thought you've won. It's very different on how they approach after the game. So seeing how you're talking about Berube, you know, what he's thinking about last game, yeah, it is a trap game. They have big games coming up.
Mm-hmm.
This is a throwaway game, essentially. So maybe after the win game against Tampa, he didn't like some details here or there, or, you know, when he called the timeout against LA, things like that. Those are just different ways to approach it as a coach. But me thinking back, it's, you know, Sutter, where we smoke a team. I think it was Dallas at home. Everyone comes in, thinks you do great, and boom, you get absolutely rinsed. That was one of the worst games he's ever saw. And you're like, what just happened? You know? So, I get how each coach goes at wins and losses. Quenville to me made the most sense after losses because you're so emotional. He never even touched it till the next day or the day after if you had a day off. And after wins, it was just a quick fist pump and get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
That made the most sense to me, but also all these coaches have won Stanley Cups that I've played for, so they've obviously get their message across one way or another.
Yeah. I just had Matt Sundin on before you, and I read his book before doing the interview, and it just hit with me where he mentioned Pat Burns, that his style was very much, if you lost and you played horribly, it was the silence, and that hurt the guys the most, where it was like, you're not even talking to you, you know, not
coming. Oh, yeah, Matt, if you lost with some of these coaches, you are on the bus, and if you hear a pin drop, you're looking around like, who made that noise, you know? you're like, please, no one cough.
Yeah.
No one, you know, yeah, there's been a lot of bus rides over a long time where you're just like, holy, I cannot even look, you know, or make a noise.
Yeah. You don't want to drink water and have it go down the wrong type of doing the like
magic. Who's choking in the back? Don't choke.
Yeah. You know, when you're trying to stifle that cough where it goes down the road and then it just explodes into like the hardest cough of your life because you tried to just keep it in for a second. It's like, no, it's got to come out. That's what.
Yeah, and then you get into that awkward laugh and then you're kind of laughing and, you know, it's
not a good one. I am curious with Berube too, like when, because so far he hasn't used the media at his disposal, and I think that he'll probably sit on that card for quite some time with his guys, but it is there, right? Like, it's just such a enticing weapon, I would think, for coaches in this market to know, hey, every once in a while you can kind of vent it out. and that it is going to be everywhere and that it is going to be a talking point and that, yeah, a player does have to be kind of on his toes about it. I just don't. When do you think that's going to happen, or if that ever happens? Because again, you played under this guy, and granted, he wasn't the head coach, but do you think that's ever going to be his style?
Well, Craig's a very honest guy, and I think he'll give you some short snippets of it. But right now, where they're sitting at and how they've been playing overall, I don't really think it's a time to panic or push certain buttons. So Craig's a smart guy. At some point, obviously, I think he will use it as his disposal, depending on how the season's going, where they're sitting in the standings, what he needs to see out of certain players. I can't see why he won't call guys out, but he does also understand, like we said, you can only do it so many times. You can only ride so many guys so long, and you can only put so much outside pressure on them when they already have so much internal pressure on themselves.
Yeah, so it's funny because, like, I texted you yesterday before the game, like, some of the topics. I'm like, hey, here's some of the stuff I want to talk about. And it was, like, all positive, right? It was like, all, hey, look how great this is and how great is this. And that was basically every question I was going to ask you. It's like, how great is this? And then insert the topic. But the one thing Berube did say, because I was watching the pregame yesterday, and they asked him, you know, what area can improve? Or I don't even know if they asked him directly what area can improve, but it was like, how excited are you by the start? And he brought up, he was like, we still got to tighten up some of our details. We got to do a few things. And you're like, yeah, it's kind of whatever. Coach gobbledygook. But then he was like, specifically the power play. And then he kind of backtracked it a little by going, hey, you know, we've had a little bit more of a good process and a couple results that have been better. And yeah, you're a guy who is got a really sharp eye for the power play units. And now they got OEL there instead of Morgan Riley running the point. You always wanted a different defenseman running it. I guess what, if anything, are you really seeing that's all that different so far strategically from them? And then two is, how much do you like the OEL move and like what you think this is actually going to do for that group, or if it needs even more change?
Well, in the past, Riley really was your best option. Mm-hmm. So having him there, I wasn't fully against it, but also trying to try new guys was a piece which Keith would never do. Now you have OEL who can walk the line, create different options. He, to me, though, like when you're watching the first power play, it's four guys standing on the perimeter. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the time you got Marner who likes the puck on the perimeter. You have Matthews who likes the puck on the perimeter. He's really the guy that'll go to the slot at times. And then you have Nylander. So you get your zone time. You're getting guys options. You're getting looks, but then you're not getting to hard areas. And for me, the simplicity of the power play, especially early on in the power play, needs to happen. You need, you know, some coaches I've played for, it's like you have a 5 second rule off a faceoff. You got to get a shot, puck retrievals. Stuff like that. You just don't see it. It's like, hold it, hold it, hold it, perimeter, perimeter, look for a grade A chance. So looking at the power play with OEL, I like him there. I like how he helps enter the zone. I like how he carries the puck up and throws for the draw pass. And he can also kick it out on both sides when the draw pass isn't there. He does it at a better rate, I think, than Riley does. But for me, back to last year, you have five guys on a unit. They all love the puck. And I'm not saying you cannot go to that situation, especially when you're down or when you need it. But I feel you need to move one of those guys onto the second unit. The second unit, they're starting to get off earlier. You can see that Craig Berube 1 minute power play is starting to happen. Not all the time. They still hang out there for their extra 30 and they try to push the envelope and then they don't score because they're tired. Mm-hmm. But you can move Nylander off that first unit. You can give them the second unit. The second unit has a tough time entering the zone. It's just dump it in, work for the puck, try to get it back. Mm-hmm. They don't have anyone who can carry the puck in the zone. I feel if you put Max and Nylander who feel well with each other, you get Nylander to be that second option now where he can enter the zone and he can do certain things. And maybe you put, I don't know who you put on the first unit, whether it could be a Bobby McMahon, or he's playing with them a lot. You know, Nyes, you have other guys that could be that hard area. You could put now Tavares to the slot, be a little more direct with Marner and and Matthews on the first unit. And then you have another guy who can carry and enter the zone on the second unit. You have Domi who can play a half wall. You can kind of play that umbrella up top and be a little more direct also with your second unit. And now you have a guy who can really control the second unit. And hopefully what you could do is pin those units against each other to be like, okay, Matthews, you think you're the first unit today? Mm-hmm. Well, Nylander's unit's going. Okay, but now we're down by a goal. Okay, take them off, put Nylander on the top unit if we need a goal really and got to go back to our loaded unit. So I just think there's more inner competition that can be done there. They can be more direct. There's only so much puck to go around. And I'm not saying it's not going to get going if you use those five guys. but you are still hedging on one unit. That means going into the playoffs, where it's generally been an issue because you only are relying on five guys to score. You need that collective unit of two units competing against each other and scoring goals and then creating that inner competition. So looking at the power play again, it's a lot of perimeter, a lot of guys standing on the outside looking for just that clean look. And I think if you take Nylander off, you get him and Domi feeling good on that second unit, create the inner competition. You have Riley who can equally run a power play as well from the back end. Now you have two units going head to head.
Yeah, it all makes too much sense, right? And I think that everyone has kind of come there. The only theory that I have for it at this point is that those guys got first crack, right? That they
yeah,
said,
they get first crack. Yeah,
yeah, that it was like, hey, you guys get a shot at this. And if it works out, great. You can all be the top power play unit that plays a minute 30. And if we get into games, like, I mean, Riley was taken off after game 5, I think. Yeah, because it's been 2 games now, I believe, that OEL's been on the top power play unit. So he got 5 games off. And now I think if it's another 5 games, like another chunk like this, maybe even less, that's when they pull the trigger. I like the idea of Domi and Nylander together more, though, on a second unit, because so far the offensive chemistry for them has been incredible. Again, I'm a curse because one of the topics I gave for you was like, what do you think of their chemistry? And then Domi played by far his worst game of the season. I was like, he's evolving as a player. And then he was dreadful. Like, it was genuinely terrible the way that he played, and it forced Brumby to break up the lines. But overall, what do you see between those two guys?
Yeah, you just see, like, Domi's so smart, and he's such a puck distributor, and it helps Nylander. They get better matchups because Matthews has to take the harder matchups. So they can kind of catch other lines, which we've always talked about. And then if you have Tavares on the three hole, you just can catch, you can catch more offense from your depth. But what I see from them is just two guys who enjoy playing with each other. Mm. With Domi, a lot of the time, if it's a back-to-back or certain times, it's just a little bit of a lack of detail. So if you see on the pinch on that first goal yesterday, he backed up the D and he went in, where he should have just pulled out and assumed the rush. And then on the other goal against, he wasn't head-checking for the guy coming behind him. So those are just the little details to his game sometimes that lack. But, hey, I mean, I was there too. But the offensive side, they really enjoy playing with each other because Max is such a pass-first guy. And Nylander needs a pass-first guy. He needs to get the puck with speed. He needs to get the puck in the O zone. He needs to feel it. And he knows Domi's looking for him at all times. So I think that's why offensively they just feel so good to each other. And that's why I think on the PP, if you have a guy that is a heavy, heavy pass-first guy, you're getting Nylander more puck touches than he probably would on the first unit.
Yeah, right now it's gone so well other than last night. But I think that last night was a good reminder for Domi. Hey, you really do have to pay attention to those kind of details, because those type of nights are what critics are going to point to that doubt whether you can play center long term with this team. And I want to see him and Nylander work out, because I do think they have chemistry together. It's two guys.
Where's Yarncroft? Sorry.
He's still hurt, but he'll be back fairly soon. But I don't know what the update is on Pacioretty, but I think he...
I would love to see Yarncroft center those two.
Yeah, you mentioned that you'd like to see him up the middle. But either I don't care who plays in the middle with them other than really Tavares, because it does whatever it is with him and Nylander, it just does not work. It doesn't fit anybody's eye.
No, but I just think Yarncroft, he's played center a long time. He's very defensively responsible. You're not going to expect him to do a ton of offensive output, but if you put him with two guys that he can kind of be that F3, let them go to work, you know, Domi, you got to get pucks out on the wall, keep his stuff more simple in the D zone. That's why I think of, like, you know, Yarncroft playing with them if he comes back. Or, you know, just give them some more defensive reliability if you're worried about Domi on some nights.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about myself and Domi as similar players in the sense of pass-first players. I played the middle, but I wasn't consistent enough to play for long stretches. They would put me for 3, 4, 5 games. And then when my details lacked, they would put a defensively responsible centerman there. Mm. And then Kane would be with me and I'd be with... and then so it's kind of similar in that sense, where the lack of details can go away from you after a certain amount of games, because maybe you are feeling offensively good and then you don't worry about the defensive side as much, and you're not as good as you think you are at that side, unless you're paying attention to detail. But that could kind of be a piece where you could put them at 4 or 5 game segments when the details lack. You can insert a defensive reliable guy, get him back on the wing feeling good, and then put him back at center. So he kind of reminds me of myself a little bit.
Yeah, listen, I hope it happens that way. Like, I don't mind if they give Yarncroft a look at the center position, like between those guys, because, everything else that you have at your disposal is not exactly obvious, right? It's like, oh, you're going to put David Kampf there? You're going to put Connor Dewar there?
Yeah,
you're going to put
Tavares? I don't mind putting David Kampf there. Yeah, I know everyone hates that. I know, but I don't mind it. If you have a defensively responsible guy, you can put him there for a couple games, right? I don't think it's that big of a deal. I truly don't.
All right. Either way,
I get both sides.
I just want to see them play together because I think they play at the same pace. I think that they, like, the chemistry between them is just very real in the sense of it's two guys, both heads up. Both guys who are not who are willing distributors. Both guys who just have patience.
You don't want to split them up.
Exactly. So you got to get creative in terms of how to keep them together. The only thing is that I do think there's going to be more attention on Domi in terms of the role will be a bit more tenuous if he has nights like the one he had yesterday, where they go, you know what, this isn't working, man. We're going to have to figure something else out, and then all of a sudden that sucks because I think we've got a good sample of him so far as a Leaf. You need him up the lineup because he's definitely a care guy, which I really like for this team. And you need him up there because he plays better with good talent and with real ice time. Last year, they buried him down on the third line with nobody to play with. And guess what? It didn't work. And, you know, you mentioned the Yarncroc thing, and this is kind of a way to get into the next one is, so hasn't been the best start for Tavares. And I've been sort of defensive about it because people are like, he looks slow. I'm like, when did he look fast? Okay, so we do this every year where it's like, people are like, he's slow. He's literally always been slow. There's never, never, ever been a burner. But he's also been playing with Nick Robertson, who just scored his first goal yesterday in cookie time, you know, like in a blowout where they, he gets one. Great. Maybe you can tell me what, if anything, that does for his confidence at this point. But yeah, Pacioretty, who had just kind of come in the lineup, maybe he and Tavares had, I thought, a little bit more chemistry together, but now maybe Pacioretty's hurt. Tavares hasn't exactly had, he's playing with Pontus Holmberg. Not the best of line mates. They're going to continue to cycle that and try to find guys, but I kept thinking that he needs Yarncroke when he comes back because he just needs another adult on his line who is reliable.
Yeah, and Yarncroke's got speed, but even then, if you have Yarncroke go up, you know, with Domi, Bobby McMahon, he's been playing good. He can bring speed. He's been, you know, hard on pucks, and he can maybe give something to
And he played well with Tavares.
Yeah, like there's just other things you can do. I'm not saying you can't put Yarncroc with him if you want to leave Domi at center. But yeah, like with John, I like where he is. You know, he looks slow. He's not playing with the most offensive guys. But if this is the Tavares you want to play down the lineup, this is the guy you're generally going to get. A guy who's offensive, a guy who's good on faceoffs. You know, he's becoming more defensive responsibility. This is a guy you'd probably want in your 3C. You know, he's not going to go out and score all the time 5-on-5 just because he's not got the line mates anymore. But I haven't really minded him at 3C overall because this is kind of what you're building for the playoffs. Yep. You need the depth. You need him understanding his role. And if he's going to sign long term, that's probably where he's going
to
play.
100%. Or he's going to get kicked out to the wing eventually throughout the tenure of that final contract. But right now they need him down the middle because, again, the options are sparse. There's no one pushing him internally like, hey, John, you got to move over the wing. He's like, for who? Doer? We're good.
Yeah, again, like, I haven't minded John. Like, I think he's doing kind of what you need him to do.
I agree. I agree with you. My point is more so that it's like you're in this year where they're taking away the captaincy from you, right? And you're looking around. It's like, okay, so now you're down on what is essentially the third line and you're not playing with a ton of talent. And I've been kind of surprised that it seems the fan base and some other people have still remained kind of critical of him because I thought that him sacrificing this many things would have resulted in a little bit of a cooling period for him. And again, most things have gone well for the Leafs, but just like I host a Leaf show and a lot of it is social and a lot of it's YouTube. So there's a ton of comments. There's a lot of things. And pretty much every night people are like, Tavares, Tavares, Tavares. And I'm the same with you. I have not noticed a guy who looks bad. He's had a couple of moments that, you know, but that's the ultimate confirmation bias where people like looking are actively looking for things to criticize with Tavares more than the other guys. But if you're him and you're in this contract year, they've taken away the captaincy and they're asking you, they're trying to squeeze you for money right now. They're looking at it and going, hey, we don't care what it used to be. You already got a ton of money here. You want to still live in your house in Etobicoke? You want to be with the Toronto Maple Leafs and finish your career here and try to win here? It's going to be for way, 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 way less. And now you're playing with Pontus Holmberg and Nick Robertson. I would be going, all right, enough is enough. Give me somebody. Give me something down here because this is just, I want to win as much as the next guy, but I also want to play with someone who can play with me.
Yeah, and like you said, he sacrificed a lot so far for the team. He's going out there. I see him competing. He's doing what he needs to do, and he's not playing with the most high-end of line mates, but he's doing exactly what he should be doing at this moment for the team. And if you're going to find a better 3C, then go out and find them. But you don't have a better 3C. You don't even really have a top 2C. So he's doing exactly what you need to do. And I have no problem with what John's been, how he's been playing. He's getting his still looks on the first power play unit. He's getting his time. And he's still, you know, he's cashed in a couple times as well, right? So I don't mind him at all and what he's doing. It's, you know, it's on the coaching staff now to hopefully find him a couple wingers or a winger that he can find some chemistry with and they can build it throughout the year, because it's not about now. It's about playoff time when you're going to need John Tavares to win a faceoff. You're going to need him, you know, to score a big goal against their third line matchup or their fourth line at times. So I've really liked what I've saw from him. I have no problem with John Tavares.
So again, one of the things I texted you that didn't materialize, because yesterday felt very familiar for the Leafs, but I was like, this feels not as familiar as the previous couple of years. The last sample of games, the five prior to the Montreal game or the preceding the Montreal game. What's looked different to you so far with this Leafs team?
Well, it's the direct play, the changing quicker on power plays, not all the time, but you can tell that the direct play. So yesterday, even on the turnover by Oliver Ekman Larson, I think it was the second goal. Was it the Danforth goal where he got it in the neutral zone and he tried to make a quick up? That's generally things you're probably going to see more from the Leafs now, not that D-to-D, hold it, let them regroup and go. So a lot faster plays. Now, that play has to be executed or he's got to wait a tad bit longer for his guys to get out and not turn it over. But just those neutral zone options where it's not as much ragging the puck. It's more about just going direct, getting back in, getting on the forecheck. And also, you know, just like I said, the details to the D zone minus yesterday, they were a little loose with the puck. I thought I saw against Tampa Bay a few times where they're just throwing the puck up the wall as a winger or a D soft plays. That will drive Berube nuts. Berube is all about, you know, if you don't have a play up, I'm sure he's telling them just to protect it and create puck battles, things like that. So those details are still coming into the game of what Craig would want. But overall, the 5-on-5 game, a little more direct, a little more hunting pucks. You're getting Bobby McMahon to play a little bit bigger, finding more roles for guys. So you can start to see it coming. And like Craig said, those details, like I said, Tanev the other day just shoots it up the wall to no one. You know, those things will drive him nuts. Or Marner just throwing it to no one up the wall. He's all about creating puck battles rather than just hope plays. So those little things are still coming along. But I think as time goes and the more, you know, he's not so much probably going to make it public. But, you know, with ice time, if you're going to make those plays, you just won't play.
To me, one of the biggest things is just like how much quicker, like you mentioned, the puck is getting out. The breakouts look astronomically different from every other year that we've ever seen with this blue line.
Yeah, you got guys who can move the puck a little bit better, and you have guys that, you know, Tanev's a really good first pass option. Oliver Ekman Larson, you know, he can really evade guys and quickly move it up the ice. He can also get the puck off the wall. That was a big issue with the Leafs. It was the old weak side rim, just rim it to your winger on the weak side, or, you know, put your winger in a bad position. These D can really pull the puck off the wall, get it to the centerman, and come out a little bit cleaner.
So a couple more things. One is, you think Oliver Ekman Larson should be in prison right now?
Prison? No.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, you were like, I can't believe it. Oh, it's the
worst. I didn't say that.
Yeah, it was so horrible. It was so dirty. Yeah, it was. Okay, this is my take. It's a penalty, but if that's a fine in the league, I just hate that as a precedent. Like, to me, Gensel is clearly going and trying to poke the puck, and the only reason it makes contact with his head is because that's what he's doing. It's an ass to the head. Like, it's not a shoulder. It's not.
Yeah, but Oliver didn't even touch the puck. So sure. Pure interference. If he touched the puck and then reverse hit him, I have no problem with it. It's the same thing in the neutral zone when the D-man passes it to a winger and the winger can't touch it and he gets absolutely folded, right? It's a play where if Oliver touches the puck and reverse hits him, it's fine, but he just let the puck go and just full-on folded him. So that,
but a fine?
It's interesting. What was the fine?
It's nothing. It's the maximum allowable, which is $5,000. But I don't even understand why people focus on that. Like, the point is not the money. Like, yeah, he's rich. I get it. He's made a ton of money in his career. I just don't like the idea that we're going to be policed in the game with hits like that, that it could cost guys money out of pocket. Like, that's just lame to me. I don't care if someone's rich. I don't care if it's less than a
what
parking fine.
What would you want from it?
Nothing. Penalty. That's max. That's what it is. It was a penalty. It was interference. Fine. It's just like, it's not the type of play that I want to have to discuss.
Again, does he get suspended?
That's what I'm saying. That's the type of precedent that I hate, is now you've got a fine. Now you've done this thing before. And so what happens with the next one? That's how these things work. That's what I'm concerned about. I don't like the message that it's sending to the league. And I also think, like, if I'm being dead honest, I do think that Parros has an agenda against the Leafs. And I'm not a conspiracy guy. I just know that this guy got knocked out clean cold by Colton Orr, and it ended his career, essentially. And, yeah, I don't know. The Leafs have clearly I've heard that they've put a lot of pressure on the Department of Player Safety, that they've never been really happy with them. I look at other plays that have happened around the league this year, including one from Pasternak, where it's literally the exact same thing as what OEL did, and it gets a nothing. And so I think that there's been a bit of a double standard. And so for me, I think it's more of an embodiment of a frustration.
Boston's never got anything.
Yeah, that's it. That's what I'm saying is, I think it's not so much like, oh, this play is such a huge deal, because, you know, you tweet about it, you get the replies that are like, cry, and only Toronto, and whatever. It's like, what do you want? It's a dirty hit. And I'm like, yeah, it's a penalty, whatever. I think for it to be a fine, for it to be escalated to there, it sets a lame precedent. But also, it's a more an embodiment of a frustration that a lot of people have here, which is like, Toronto seems to have been dealt with by the Department of Player Safety differently than other teams around the league. Sorry, they just have.
Well, yes and no. I guess it's your team. So there is. I do think with Boston, though, I mean, I can go back to 2010, 11, 12. Mm-hmm. And I've never thought that Boston's been dealt with accordingly with a lot of the plays and the stuff with fines and suspensions. That'd be one team I'd give to you. But I think overall it is very inconsistent.
Yeah.
And that goes across the board, not just the Leafs. I watch a lot of things that I think are very inconsistent. I watch, you know, Sam Bennett, who's a good friend, but like, he punches Marchand in the head last year in playoffs, and there's nothing. I know that's now against Boston, but you know, there's a lot of plays that happen like that are not dealt with correctly, and then all of a sudden the next day it's dealt with. So the inconsistency has always been a problem, and it still continues.
Okay, so last one. I had Mats on, and you didn't reply. You big dogged me yesterday. I was like, yo, if you want to do this, you can tell me, because I'm setting you up for a question that maybe you're not going to answer. But...
Oh, Mats. I love Mats, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, when you think about his career, you have a memory of like either playing with him or getting like anything.
I never played with him, but my second year in the league, he signed with Vancouver.
Yeah.
And we were playing them. This is, I think it would have been one of his first two games, and we were in Vancouver. And he came down his offside. I've never seen this before, and took a slap shot on the off wing and went far post and in. And I was like, how is that even, like, physically possible? It was just something where I was like, man, I've watched this guy play my whole life as a kid. You know, I was a huge fan of Mats, and then to see him do that. And then, you know, we played them in the playoffs. They were the favorites going into that year. We ended up beating them in game six. But I remember taking a face-off against Mats, and he ripped the stick out of my hand like I was like a child. Like, it was crazy.
I mean, there's weight classes for a reason. Like, well, you're half his size.
Legit. Yeah. I remember looking at him in the face-off, and it's probably what, like, a lightweight looks at when he sees a, you know, a super heavyweight in boxing.
Yeah.
And then when he ripped my stick out of my hand, I was just like, oh, dear. You know, there's another weight class for this whole thing. So those are my real two fond memories of Mats, but just getting to play with him and getting to compete against him. I remember you try to up your game because you're like, man, this is a guy that I've idolized, and now I get to go against him. I'm going to bring it.
Yeah.
It's really special.
Although you probably felt like a bit of a boy when you're like going to pick up your stick after.
Thank you.
Yeah, like, you know, like, oh, that's mine there. I'm going to get that. You're like, yeah, sure. You grab it. Get out of here, kid. Like, that's what that one is. Hey, buddy. Again, Christopher Stieg, creator of the Clever app, which you can download for free in the App Store. I highly recommend it. So go check that out, especially if you're involved in youth sports. Hey, man, thanks for making time today. I always appreciate it.
For sure. Take care.
See you, buddy. Christopher Stieg. All right, let's take a quick break. Let's come back and hit what we missed. There's plenty of stuff in here, but hopefully we can squeeze a bunch in.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
All right. What do we miss? Who wants to take the ball? Actually, let's start with the Lakers still. Let's close the book on the Lakers stuff, because I've been mentioning that I couldn't have gotten off to a worse start to the season in terms of basketball takes. It's like, Lakers look good.
I was going to text you at halftime, like, LeBron is not losing this game. After that Bronny stint, I'm telling you.
No, I felt like an idiot because Yeah, you're right. They were clearly getting up for that game. Where it's like, this is a home opener. Bronny's going to be in the building. Lakers are going to win this. And then I underestimated how disconnected the Timberwolves would look after the trade. I just thought, oh, they got most of the pieces. They're mixing in two guys. And I thought Randall would still have a little bit of like revenge game element against his old team. And he just like, he was passive. He didn't even want to take a shot until the second quarter. He just was like, yeah, I'm not really here. I went, ooh, this isn't good for the belief that he's going to be good on this team. But the part I was kind of surprised by is Ant. Like, I thought he was going to get up for this game. It's like, dude, you're on the opener against the Lakers. Let's go kill them. And no, it's kind of like pretty whatever. Yeah, he celebrated some threes he hit in front of the benches, but yeah, overall, it wasn't a great Ant game. Anyway, all right. So the thing that I also mentioned is I know I'm going to be sick of J.J. Redick. And why did this come up?
So the Lakers shot 10 for 32 yesterday.
Yeah, that was the thing. That was the worst part about it is Minnesota was just turning the ball over and playing horrifically. And it's like they're a big team and they can't get rebounds. You're like, God, this is just effort. But yeah, so they bring this up because the bad shooting. Okay, that makes sense because I didn't see why the question. But so he's asked about the misses.
Yeah, he's like, what did you think about the looks you got from the three-point line?
So then this was his answer.
Threes there in the second half that I thought were wide open and we just couldn't knock them down. I'm going to send in a request for the league tomorrow that we can play with worn-in basketballs. I'm not sure why we're playing in real games. I'm being dead serious. I'm not sure why we're playing in real games with brand new basketballs. Anybody who's ever touched an NBA ball brand new, it's a different feel and touch than a worn-in basketball. I didn't realize it till a timeout. There's a long rebound. I grabbed it. I was like, what? Why are we playing with this ball? Give the guys the opportunity to pick a good basketball.
Okay, that's enough. I hate this guy. I'm so glad. So I was never like a big J.J. Redick hater. I wasn't. I actually kind of like
You're not a Duke guy, but
no, I'm not a Duke guy, but I've never been like a Duke hater. Like been like anyone but Duke. In fact, I've cheered for a few Duke teams. I'm from the North, and so I cheered for the Boozer team with Trajan Langdon. I liked that they had Alaskans on them as a kid. I liked Jason Williams, too. I really did. I was like, yes, I root for this guy. I hated that he ended up losing his career. He was someone I was invested in. I really liked Grant Hill, I mentioned. I've had a long history. The Zion RJ team is about as invested as I've been in recent history in a college basketball team. And I respected J.J. Redick's game, and I respected the fact that he wore the hatred he got gym to gym as a badge of honor. That was actually like a marker of, I appreciate this guy. Throughout his career, I just respected his work ethic and the ability to stay in the league, that he did various roles. I've never been a J.J. Redick hater, straight up. Never, never, ever, ever. Until like the very end of his career when he started doing the podcast and he started doing the whole shtick of everybody's stupid but me.
Yeah, you don't get basketball the way that
everyone's an idiot except for J.J. Redick. And I went, oh, God, this is kind of annoying, man. And then he had the LeBron pod where he's like, let's have wine and talk about how stupid everybody is. I was like, ugh. Oh, let's just, everyone's an idiot, right, Bron? He's like, yeah. And he's like, I didn't get this job because of Bron. It's like, okay, whatever, man. You really do think everybody's stupid. J.J. Redick, you got to shut up. Like, you got to not do stuff. Like, I touched the ball, and it was brand new, and I'm sending a request to the league. No other coach ever brought this up. Every hooper knows that you want to have your ball, duh.
Yeah,
you want to have the worked-in ball. Having a brand new ball, I understand that that's not the, like, best of all situations, but what, you get to choose the ball, JJ? Like, who's choosing the ball? That's the whole point, is that it's completely fresh and brand new, and no one gets to choose, like, hey, this is the game ball. This isn't a pickup run. This isn't, like, you passing it to the other guy on the other team going, like, hey, you get your opportunity. Hey, you good with this ball? You good with this? You start doing the dribble test, like, see how much air is in it to see, like, it's the NBA, J.J. Redick. What are you talking about here? Why do you think no one has brought this up? It's because you think you're a super genius.
And this is the other thing, is like, if he says, I didn't realize till I touched the ball, none of the other players anything.
That's what I mean.
So no
that's
one cared.
Dude.
And now you're going to write the league? Like, I'm going to write a sternly worded letter to the league.
LeBron James.
Oh, my God.
LeBron James, a guy who spends over $1 million on his body, is meticulous with every single detail, cries about everything. He is a crier. We can all admit, right? He cries. Except for Mike, who's like, he's amazing in every way, and you're just a hater. if he's not bringing it up, like, JJ, why, man? Why? Why do you have to be this way? the amount of times that you're going to hear stuff like this throughout the season is just going to be insufferable.
Thank God it wasn't after a loss.
That would have been way worse.
Yeah, that's true.
He was also chirping Ant a little bit during the game. He's just going to be an annoying coach.
That's fine. I actually don't mind that part. And I actually love having sports hate for someone. I really do.
Because
I've mentioned this before. One of the things that I, like, as actually I've gotten older, I respect Kobe so much more just in terms of the work ethic stuff and, just who he was as a person, the uncompromising nature of him, the drive, the desire, especially given I think that the new age has fewer guys like him, even though so many guys are inspired by him. But I loved to root against Kobe Bryant. Like, he was the perfect sports foil. I genuinely despised him. And when he retired, I was like, I'm never going to feel this way again. And J.J. Redick is like, I'm like the old scout who's seen it all, and I'm just in the stands one day, and all of a sudden I see a kid and throws 110.
That guy's got something.
What? But he's wild. He's all over the place. He can't control the pitch. But I see him, and I go, this is hope for me. I'm Adam Sandler in that basketball movie with Anthony Edwards. I'm overseas, and I'm just beaten down, and I don't think it's gone anywhere.
J.J. Redick is your Hernan Gomez.
Yeah, he's my guy, yeah.
Nice.
I'm like, wait, what was his name in the movie?
I can't remember.
Bo Cruz.
Yeah,
Cruz Missile.
No. Yeah, I almost said Bo Bichette. I remembered. I was like, is this Bo Bichette? No, it's a different guy. Anyway, yeah, that's me watching J.J. Redick. Like, I might hate again.
That's
like,
good.
Mike thinks I'm a hater of LeBron. Bro, you've never even seen me hate. You've never even seen me dig in. And this is going to be a whole, oh my God. The level of sports hate I am going to bring towards this man if he keeps this up is going to be, like, you're going to learn. You're going to learn, Mike.
I'm excited.
Yeah, are you?
Because you are a LeBron hater.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of sports hate, by the way, I think we all...
There's nothing better than that move. It's more immature than making fun of someone's laugh by just doing it back to them right away, but it works every time.
Oh, that gets people pissed.
And the worst part is I have a terrible laugh. So when I do it to other people, I'm just inviting it coming back to me, and I've heard my laugh before, and every time I'm like, retirement sounds good. Even now, I'm like, don't laugh. Don't laugh at your own joke.
No, I've never thought yours was that bad, buddy.
I think mine's just an easy one to make fun of, like, ho, ho, ho.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
it's a ho, ho, ho laugh, so it's an easy one to go at in that way. Mike's is a little bit of a tee-hee laugh, a little mischievous, like, hee-hee, like, ha-ha-ha. Yeah, that's his. So I'm on you. I'm getting you with that when you get on my nerves. I'm just going right at your laugh. I won't tolerate it coming back to me. I'm going to be double standard guy. What's next?
Speaking of sports hate, let's just quickly do some Joel Embiid stuff. We all love to hate Joel Embiid.
I do hate Joel Embiid as well. Yeah. I do. I really do. You know what? This is true. I can't stand Joel Embiid. I hate his guts. The thing is, I never really hated Joel. Like, I hated him in the Raptors series, obviously, but I've always kind of rooted for him to stay healthy. But then the USA Olympic thing was the death knell for me ever having an ounce of sympathy for him. So now,
his
I'm even like doing stuff like it wasn't all Ben Simmons' fault. So I'm with Mike now on that. I'm leaning towards like, kind of Joel scapegoated that guy. Kind of a loser. Anyways, what's the Joel thing?
Well, his bad offseason is continuing. Oh, yeah. He's going to miss the season opener. So is Paul George. They're both potentially also going to miss the Friday game against the Raps. So, I mean, it's already looking like a season.
I think they're both out. Maybe Paul George.
Yeah, Paul George might. Yeah. He's kind of a maybe. It seems like he will miss it. Anyway, it already seems like it's a nightmare season for the Sixers. You think it's going to be a bad one, or you think they can kind of withstand?
No, I think this is fine. Honestly, the more games Joel Embiid misses, the better for them. Because, again, this guy has nothing to prove in the regular season. And, it's kind of annoying, and people are going to want to trounce the Sixers. But I said yesterday, I don't care about them until the postseason. Mm-hmm. And so he's kind of like the number one player in the NBA right now where you can put him on ice and break him out for the postseason, and I'm going to go like, okay, cool. Yes, there's going to be a level of games missed where it is going to detract from if he was to win, right? Because if you play half the season and it's all this like rest and recovery and they're really babying you, and then you're beating teams in the postseason where guys have played the regular season, I am going to go, hey, look at the way they approach this. This is a little greasy. Like, he didn't have to go through the vigors or the rigors of a regular season. It should be noted in the championship discussion. We break down all of them. We measure all the rings, right?
For sure.
So that'll be a part of it. But yeah, I this was actually one where I didn't feel connected with the overarching narrative of like, oh wow, Sixers went. There's nothing less important to the Sixers than the first game of the season. Mm. It's the last game. So this is nothing to me. other than the Raptors are just going to play Tyrese Maxey, and now
Maxey's probably going to burn them.
Yeah, I take them over in Maxey points in that game, for sure.
For sure. DeAndre Hopkins got traded to the Chiefs early this morning.
Everyone's coming in.
It's like a conditional fourth, I believe. I'll double check this. Fifth round pick that can become a fourth round pick. So another big receiver kind of gets traded, or at least, you know, old.
Old guy.
At one point big. There's also rumors that Cooper Kupp could be moved from the Rams. Like, what are your thoughts on the wide receiver
stuff? The Chiefs couldn't absorb the Kupp money is the issue?
Yeah. Someone said that it was a combo between Kupp money and obviously he would have cost more. So the Chiefs kind of got a lower round pick.
Well, and if you're the Chiefs and every single guy is getting hurt on your team, you probably don't need to add Cooper Kupp to the mix going, hey, you know who will probably stay healthy for us? I don't really have any Hopkins opinions. Because who is watching Titans games? I watched one versus the Jets. It just, like, all you need to see from the Titans games is the Will Levis meme of the day. Yeah. He's horrific. And it's just like, he is like Mark Sanchez gets clowned on forever for the butt fumble, right?
Yeah.
This guy has a butt fumble every
weekly,
game.
Baby.
He's a weekly butt fumble. And he's no good. Sanchez was good. Sanchez was a good player in college.
AFC
and took a
team
championship. Yeah. Compared to Will Levis.
He's a Hall of Famer.
Yes, exactly. He's Tom Brady to Will Levis. So what DeAndre Hopkins is at this point of his career is a complete unknown, because he's going from Mason Rudolph and Will Levis to Patrick Mahomes. I think that the more interesting part of this is the Chiefs saying, yeah, we know. 6 touchdowns, 8 interceptions. Mahomes is at the top of the MVP rankings. Sure. It's all quiet now, but that first loss that the Chiefs have and they can't score any points, people are going to say what we all, I think, realize at this point, which is that they're a defensive team that's being led by Spags and his group more than they are an offensive team being led by Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes right now. And yes, that can shift. And there is something to be said for Mahomes' clutch factor and the idea that you feel so confident he's going to find a way to win the game at the end of it, that he's never going to feel the pressure of the moment and you just need to keep him around. But the offense just needs more than what they have right now. Kelce does not look consistently great. They threw a ball to, what's his name, Sky Moore, who I think they drafted in the second round the other day, and they went, Sky Moore's first target of the season, first catch of the season, and the season dropped it horrifically, and you went, yeah, he sucks. You can't play that guy. So they at least went out and got a reliable set of hands of, hey, this is going to be thrown in the vicinity and you're probably going to come down with it. So I like it for the Chiefs. But yeah, the year of the old receiver, trying to revitalize teams' Super Bowl championship aspirations. Anyways, first Raptors game of the season tonight. Can't wait to watch it. Joe Cacharo tomorrow and Myrtle. So we'll watch the first game of the season. We'll see you tomorrow. Subscribe to the podcast. Leave 5 stars. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram @JD Bunkus. Reach out anytime. See you tomorrow.